I find this exploration of the ancestors a lot more interesting and engaging than I thought it was going to be. Somehow the idea of ancients and Chinese ancestors and reading a lot of fairly dry talks didn't really inspire me that much, but I'm really enjoying it, hearing everybody else's talks. And then the ancestor that I'm decided to get to know a little bit better is named Shito. Pronouncing that right?
Shito. Yep, Shito.
Yeah. So I'm going to talk about him this morning. And he's one that wasn't really well known in his lifetime, but became famous several decades after, and really to this day because of two poems that we use a lot today. And one of them is in our chant books. And anybody who's been hanging around for a while and doing services, you probably have chanted it quite a few times. And I'd like to just start, I'll tell you a little bit first about a little bit more about Shito. So he was born in 700 Common Era, and he lived to the age of 90. He became a student of the very well-known sixth patriarch, Huineng, when he was just a young teenager. But Huineng died several years after that, I believe, so he then was studying with Huineng's disciple, or teacher, who was Qingzi. So I'm trying to get these Chinese names. And he lived and taught at Nantai Temple in Hunan. And that doesn't mean a lot to me because I haven't been to China and not too familiar with the geography. And I'm sure I'll forget these names after today. But that's where he lived and taught. And he was known as a bit of a hermit because he lived, most of his life, his entire life, in a small hut on top of a big stone. And that's apparently how he came to be known as Shito, which can be translated as Stonehead. And he wasn't that well known during the time. I think he lived in the southern part of China, and he didn't have a lot of disciples. He just kind of sat there on his stone hut and thought a lot and wrote these beautiful poems. But he was really aware of what was going on around the world, which was for him was China at that time. And there were a lot of different schools of Buddhism starting and forming and debating about what was true and what was the best way to practice. And then it wasn't until decades after his death that he became seen as a core part in the lineage for Soto Zen, which is the lineage that we practice here today. So important in our history and lineage. And these two poems are quite well known. And the two of them, one is called The Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage, and the other one is Sandokai, or The Merging of Difference and Unity. So if we could just get the chant books. It's on page 8. And just start off by chanting this. One more time. And it's interesting, there's different translations of all these texts that we have, and sometimes, you know, a different word will make us see it in different ways. So I might refer to a couple of different translations or words during my talk, but we you know, they come to us originally from the Chinese, this one particularly, with different ways of writing. Like, they didn't use words, it was more symbols that would evoke images. So this one called Sandokai, or Harmony of Difference and Unity, is sometimes called Merging of Difference and Unity. And just about chanting, like, it's something we do quite a lot here, and I've come to really, really appreciate it as something beautiful. I hate to miss any of the services or chants, and that wasn't how I felt the first few years that I was coming around. But there's something about us all joining our voices and our intentions to chant something, which we might not even understand, even if it's in English, this one we got a translation in English, and I've, for many years, not really understood it. Sometimes we're chanting them in a different language, like Japanese, but there's something about our voices saying the same things over and over, with the intent that we really know, and some part of us, the intent that we know, is behind the words. Let's start. I'll read the title, and you can do it like a regular chant. Harmony of difference and equality.
The mind of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted from west to east. While human faculties are sharp or dull, the way has no northern or southern ancestors. The spiritual source shines clear in the light. The branching streams flow on in the dark. Grasping at things is surely delusion. According with sameness is still not enlightenment. All the objects of the senses interact and yet do not. Interacting brings involvement, otherwise each keeps its place. Sights vary in quality and form. Sounds differ as pleasing or harsh. Refined and common speech come together in the dark. Clear and murky phrases are distinguished in the light. The four elements return to their natures, just as a child turns to its mother. Fire heats, wind moves, water wets, earth is solid. Eye and sights, ear and sounds, nose and smells, tongue and taste. Thus with each and everything, depending on these roots, the leaves spread forth. Trunk and branches share the essence. Revered and common, each has its speech. In the light there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the dark there is light, but don't see it as light. Light and dark oppose one another like the front and back foot in walking. Each of the myriad things has its merit, expressed according to function and place. Phenomena exist, box and lid fit, principle responds, arrow points meet. Hearing the words, understand the meaning, don't set up standards of your own. If you don't understand the way right before you, how will you know the path as you walk? Progress is not a matter of far or near, but if you are confused, mountains and rivers block your way. I respectfully urge you who study the mystery, do not pass your days and nights in vain.
This writing by Shito is in a lot of ways his way to express his understanding of the relationship between the absolute and the relative. So in this poem it's difference and equality, or sometimes difference and unity, but it's looking at that struggle we have to balance our individuality, our separation, our separateness, and our oneness, the spiritual source, and that we all are one. So the absolute and the relative. And he does this somewhat in the beginning part by contrasting the beliefs of the different schools at the time. So it helps a little bit to understand what he was, you know, dealing with at that time and what the debates were about. And what I find fascinating about this is that, you know, that this was a long time ago, and I think of them as our ancient wise Zen ancestors who probably had it all together, and if I could only have been back there with them or really studied what they're saying, I would be enlightened as well. But they were really grasping with the same questions that we do really every day in our lives and on our cushions. So that whole paradox of oneness and separateness, and they can seem irreconcilable. But he mentions, in that second line, while human faculties are sharp or dull, the way has no northern or southern ancestors. And he's referring to the different schools of thoughts, and I'm just going to say a little bit about them. In China, there were several branches, probably about six or seven different schools of thought about Buddhism. And a couple of the main ones were the northern school and the southern school. And the Northern School believed that we need to practice constantly to remove the stain of our delusions and the stain of our discriminating minds and return to the purity of one mind. And they saw this as a gradual enlightenment, like there's this jewel kind of within us that's our spiritual source, our one mind, and it's covered over by all of our delusions, and we have to keep polishing it by our practice. So that's kind of a gradual process. So in a way, they emphasize difference or separateness and try to transcend it through unity or oneness. And then the Southern School, I think the Northern School was the more prominent in the day.
Yes.
The Southern School believed that everything we are and do is a function of Buddha nature, and we just have to realize this. It's like our delusions are part of our Buddha nature. We can't avoid them. They're part of our reality. They're part of our growth and our path. And we just have to realize this and accept everything that we do and in our life as Buddha nature. And this is a sudden realization or a sudden enlightenment. And the way you could say that for them, unity or oneness is found only found in difference, as there's no unity outside of difference. So we must accept difference. And then another school of thought was that everything is empty. You know, we should not grasp at anything, and our practice is not to attach ourselves to anything, not to difference or to unity. They're both empty, and we should just strive to become free from these distinctions. Another thought line was that our discriminations are false and empty delusions, but at the same time, they believe that oneness or unity is not empty. So we cannot grasp it, but it's here and clear and bright. And we must realize this brightness and practice to free ourselves from delusions. So differences in this school were empty while unity is not. And they see this as a combination of gradual practice and sudden enlightenment. So there's a lot of discussions and arguments, you know, about reality and oneness, separateness, and how to best practice. I mean, we all want to do it best, right? So that wasn't different back then. And so this was the milieu that Shitu was living in and practicing in and aware of. Probably not by internet like we do now, but I guess they traveled and word spread and they knew what different people were thinking. So he suggested that we focus on the relationship between difference and unity. And not emphasize either, but see reality as emerging of them both. And when he says human faculties may be sharp or dull, but in the path there are no southern or northern ancestors, he's saying there's no difference between sudden and gradual enlightenment. You know, people have different capabilities, so some understand suddenly and some more gradually. But in reality, there's no distinction. And he sort of feels it senseless to say that one approach is superior or better than another. And he tries to show this sense of one mind or essence before we separate it into absolute and relative. It's kind of the before our minds sort of make those concepts. And he calls this one mind, which he said in the beginning, he calls this one mind the mind of the great sage of India. That's kind of a symbol. So he's saying the mind of the great sage of India, which is really that one mind that we all share, is intimately transmitted from west to east. It's everywhere. It's not sort of north, south, west, or east. So the next lines there in the poem are, and if you want, you can just read along, or I'll say them. And then one thing I meant to say at the beginning after we read the poem, and you may remember it now, is just to, if there's any parts of it that jump out to you that you don't really get or they don't make sense, just to kind of keep them in mind, and we'll come back to it at the end. Or on the other hand, if there's something that really rings to you as a beautiful way of expressing your truth. So, and the same as we go through these lines, you see what kind of makes sense to you and what you're sort of backing up with. So the next one is, the spiritual source shines clear in the light. The branching streams flow on in the dark. Grasping at things is surely delusion. According with sameness is still not enlightenment. So I have found these lines a little bit confusing, And I understand more. I've been reading this book by Shohaku Okamura called Living by Vow, and he's got a chapter on this Sandokai, which I found really helpful. And he looked at some of these symbols and words that were used in the original poem. And he uses light and darkness a lot here, and that's kind of the absolute, the relative, unity, separateness, light and dark. And the Chinese symbol for spiritual source or unity is Ri, and it's also a symbol for darkness. So it's like the unity, the oneness, is what's being referred to as darkness here. And to me, that's a little counterintuitive. I sort of thought, well, you know, oneness is more like enlightenment. That would be bright. But in this language, this symbol, the darkness is the unity, the one source. And G is the symbol for difference or separateness, and that is light. So if we look at that line again, the spiritual source shines clear in the light. So that's sort of meaning that the oneness, the spiritual source or unity, shines clearly in the light, which is separation or differentiation. And it's also a little bit of a dichotomy there, that typically if you think of something shining clear and bright, it's like the full moon, which we see today, the last few days. And usually you just see it when it's shining in the dark, right? So it's kind of makes your mind stop a little bit. It's going, the spiritual source shines clear in the light. And then the branching streams, which is kind of branching out from that oneness into all of our individuality and relativeness, they flow on in the dark, and the dark here is in the unity. So it's a really beautiful kind of weaving together, winding together those two aspects, which is what his real message is. And then grasping at things is surely delusion. Well, that's like, we all kind of know that, right? You kind of try to hang on to anything, immediately you get that karmic feedback. But then he's, and for us that's really easy. It's easy in our upbringing and culture to relate to that individuality and separateness. Like, that's part of our culture. It's our government, our schooling, most of our religions. But he says, according with sameness is still not enlightenment. So it's not like doing the opposite and going, you know, like the guy that goes to the pizza shop and says, make me one with everything. Like that's not really, that's not enlightenment either. And it's kind of, in our Zen practice, we're individual, we realize that oneness, and it's always important to bring it back to our lives, you know, what we're doing right now, this body, this mind, this problem, this joy, and seeing that interaction at all times. So we can really see this dichotomy, you know, of separateness and togetherness in our lives. Like, we are all separate individuals. I was noticing that sitting here this morning. Like, we sit, each of us, on a cushion, and I don't know what you're feeling. You've got pain in your knee or not, and I don't know what your thoughts are, but I know you're thinking. we have our you know, kind of our little worlds here. We're individuals. We can't really deny that at all. We're born alone. We live alone. We die alone. And at the same time, none of us could be here without the support and connection of everyone else and everything else in this world. We're born of parents, all of our food, you know, there's so much connection between the sun, the earth, the plants, the people that bring it to us. Our thoughts and minds, even, like we share, we chant together, we share ideas. So we interact a lot, we depend on each other. So we're completely independent and completely interdependent, and at the same time. And then these next lines are saying, all the objects of the senses interact and yet do not. Interacting brings involvement, otherwise each keeps its place. Sights vary in quality and form, sounds differ as pleasing or harsh. Refined and common speech come together in the dark. Clear and murky phrases are distinguished in the light. And so all the objects of the senses and their sense, what they the senses land on, our eyes and what they see, ears and what they hear. These are our gateways. The senses are our gateways. So from inside this little package to everything outside, our senses are what allow us to see and hear and interact and get involved with the world. So he's kind of looking at that. And again, that... we have these different senses which are really unique and not interchangeable, like the ears can't smell and our eyes can't hear. So we have these different gateways, and yet they interact together to form involvement. That's what allows us to see and be part of the world and of each other. And just an analogy that Okamura uses about all different instruments in an orchestra. They're quite unique, they're not interchangeable, but when they work together you hear kind of the music that they're creating. And then when they're not playing, when their senses aren't interacting, they return to their places. They don't merge. And then this sight's quality vary in quality and form. Sounds differ as pleasing or harsh. Again, as individuals interacting, we have some sounds we like, some we don't, some are pleasant. And we might like a song at a particular time in our lives and a few years later not like it, or like to have quiet at some times, or talking at other times. The same with all of our senses. And again, it's part of that needing to honor our own perspective, that individuality is really important as part of this involvement with the world and with unity. And again, the reference here to light and dark, refined and common speech come together in the dark. So refined and common speech, that's like looking at opposites, like enlightenment, not enlightenment. We could use lots of different ones. They come together in the dark. So again, dark is unity, and dark's where we don't differentiate. We can't see things as difference. So those things come together, you know, in that sense of unity or darkness, the differences don't matter. We don't see them. And then clear and murky phrases are distinguished in the light. So then we have the light side to see the difference. And when we practice or sit, we have this opportunity to actually merge with difference and unity. We see them as both a part of a reality, because we sit individually. But while we're sitting, we really see that nothing is permanent. And we get those tenets of Buddhism, and we start to really feel the emptiness of this one self. We start to just feel that, even if it's not an intellectual thought, that there's no separate self. I'm just going to read a little bit from this book, because I can't say it as beautifully as he does. In Zazen, you should keep this upright posture. Breathe quietly through your nose and let go of everything. We don't try to control anything, just keep this posture and let go. That is how darkness and light manifest. Thought is still there, yet we don't think. It's a difficult point to explain. It's like when you are driving a car and shift into neutral. The engine is moving, but the car doesn't go anywhere. In our Zazen, we put our mind into neutral. Thought is there, but we are not moved by it. My teacher, Uchiyami Roshi, said, "Thought is just a secretion from our brain. Thought is not a poison. But if you grasp and are controlled by it, it becomes poisonous." We actualize both darkness and light when we open our hand of thought and are not moved. That is sitting practice. Our Zazen is not a method to contemplate reality which has lightness and dark. It is a way to manifest both darkness and light. We are not the observer, but rather the reality itself. And the next section of the Sandokai says, the four elements return to their natures just as a child turns to its mother. Fire heats, wind moves, water wets, earth is solid. Eye and sights, ear and sounds, nose and smells, tongue and taste. And here he's referring to the four elements from which we are all made. So fire, wind, water, earth. And in Mahayana Buddhism, there's a fifth element, which is space, because everything exists in space. So fire is like in our body heat and energy, and wind is our breathing and moving, Water is the blood, tears, bloody fluids. And earth are the solid things like bone, hair, and nails. So we're all made up of these little elements. And they create everything in the universe, not just our bodies, but everybody here, everything in the room, everything in the universe are made of these elements. And they all have, so that we can break things down, I think it's a way of looking at how we're not just one chunk of things. And even the four elements have their own natures, which aren't interchangeable. And I find that image about the child turning to its mother is kind of a comforting one. I sort of hear that in a number of different sort of Zen stories, that mother and child thing. It's in the Metta Sutta as well. So there's something that I think in some ways we can all relate to, and he's going, those four elements and their natures are, you know, they're bonded, and they work together within us to create who we are. And then again, it's not, they aren't us, we aren't this separate little thing. And our gateways with the eye and ears and nose and smell and taste. And then he says, thus with each and everything, depending on these roots, the leaves spread forth. So this is another image similar to the one he has about the spiritual source shines clear in the dark, branching streams flow on. Sorry, spiritual source shines clear in the light, and the branching streams flow on in the dark. So in this sort of image, the roots are the essence, the spiritual source, and the leaves spread forth, that's individuality. Trunk and branches share the essence. Revered and common, each has its speech. So the revered and common that we have in speech, that's just we have different ways of categorizing and naming these things, but they share the essence. Now this next bit. I've come to like more than I used to before I started looking at it. So I'm just going to read it and see what happens just as you hear it in your sort of mind. What's your reaction? In the light there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the dark there is light, but don't see it as light. Light and dark oppose one another like the front and back foot in walking. Now, for me, all the times we've chanted this, my brain kind of goes, wait a minute, and I try to back up and figure it out, but it doesn't usually work, because in chanting, you're just on the train, right? But, which is a good thing about chanting. It's not like reading a book, and you go back and read something over and over. It's like, just let it sort of sink in. So with knowing what these symbols mean, though, for me now, in the light there is darkness. So it's like right in there, our differentness, there is unity. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. But don't take it as darkness. So it's again that bit I think about, don't holding on to just being one, just becoming, you know, letting go of our individuation. And in the dark there is light, but don't see it as light. So they're all there, and you don't have to kind of just accept that they're there, and we don't have to stop and really make them as distinct things. Then light and dark oppose one another like the front and back foot in walking. So it's just as in our two feet and our two legs, light and exist together in our bodies. Light and dark exist together. And sometimes, as in walking, we only see our left foot or our right foot. So sometimes we only see difference and separation, and sometimes we only see unity and oneness. But in reality, they're always moving together as we move through our life. I think that's a beautiful image, actually. And then each of the myriad things has its merit, expressed according to function and place. And here it's like all these little bits that we have in our world and ourselves and our mind, they all have their merit. It's like we don't have to cast away anything or judge it. But expressed according to function and place. So it's important that we see them in their own, in their right place, and we find our place in the world with our particular skills and challenges. That's kind of our responsibility, is to know that there is a right function and place, and to find ourselves there. Phenomena exist. I find that one hard to argue about. That made sense to me. And then apparently these next two lines are really one sentence. So phenomena exist, box and lid fit. Principle responds, arrow points meet. So we've got phenomena and we have principle or unity responding. And it's like box and lid fit, they fit together perfectly, you know, unity and difference, like a box and a lid. And then the reference to the arrow points meeting is comes from an old Chinese story, which probably a lot of you have heard before a few times, which I had, but I really like it. I like getting refreshed on it. So it refers to an archery teacher and his really very talented student. And when the student felt that he matched or surpassed the skill of his teacher, he challenged him to a duel. So they do it, and they both shot their arrows into the air, and because they were so equally skilled, the arrows met in midair and dropped to the ground. So they both lived because they were equally skilled. And our lives go smoothly when the arrow points of difference and unity meet in midair. We can have that, that image. So coming to the end of the poem, he's got hearing the words, understand the meaning, don't set up standards of your own. He's giving us this warning, because anything expressed in words is based on our ability to discriminate. We have language because we categorize, label, and name things. And it's important not to get caught up in the words or the images. But he goes, we should just understand the meaning. Easy, right? So I'm going to read again what he says here in reference to this line. How can we go beyond the discrimination between absolute and relative, or discrimination and non-discrimination? The only way is to see the source, the reality as it exists before being processed by our thinking mind. To do so, we need practice. Any theoretical system of concepts or thoughts is a distorted copy of reality. We can only practice it, experience, and nod our head. All doctrines, theories, and descriptions using words and concepts are distorted images of reality from our own point of view. When we realize this, even a distorted copy can be useful. However, if we mistake the distorted map for true reality, we stray, making up our own standards of judgment. So if you don't understand the way right before you, how will you know the path as you walk? When our understanding is based in reality, the path is always right here in front of us. We're always on it, moment by moment. But if we make up our own maps or versions of reality, then we are blocked by mountains and rivers in our mind. Progress is not a matter of far or near, but if you are confused, mountains and rivers block your way. So progress is not a race or a competition. We don't have a starting line and a finishing line. And each person's journey is unique. But there's no question we support each other on the journey, and we don't do it alone. And just by sitting in zazen and letting go of our thoughts, we can allow our whole being to be settled on the ground of reality and keep coming back to it. So this last line, I actually really love this last line. I respectfully urge you who study the mystery, do not pass your days and nights in vain. I always thought this, I always feel a bit guilty when I heard or read this. It's like, oh, I'm not doing enough. You know, sort of felt like you're saying, don't be lazy, like work harder. And now I kind of hear it more as like, it doesn't matter how hard you work, but if you don't have the right understanding with every breath, with every step, whether you're sitting or you're making dinner, walking the dog, it's like you're passing your night, days and nights in vain. So it's not so much how hard you work, but just to have that right understanding and to keep coming back to it. So I am really happy to be one who is studying the mystery. And this is a group I'm really proud to belong to. And I want to wish you all happiness as we practice together and find Buddha's way. And I'm going to end my talk here. And we have a few minutes to do a little mini discussion. And what I'm going to suggest is if you remember what those lines were at the beginning when we read through the chant that either grabbed you that you didn't get or you really liked, to just get in groups of three and just have about 3 minutes each to just talk about that line and what either you don't get about it or if there's any difference now from going through it with what we've discussed, what your understanding is of it now. Does that sound okay?